You're listening to The Running Public.
From marathoners to mud runners, we all have the same goal. Get to the finish line faster.
That's right. This podcast is for you guys, the running public.
Do I look sun-kissed right now? See that little like burn on the tip of my chin and my cheeks here?
A little bit on the forehead. Well, people don't normally get chin burns. Yeah, but I do see it now. Yeah, now that you changed the...
Just the top of it.
You got a spot on this top side of your head. Yeah, what's been going on?
Crushing some hills today, Kirk.
Yeah, I see it. Now that you've pointed it out, I can't not see it. It's one of those things. It's a little splotchy.
Yeah, and part of it's I'm blotchy from the workout. It was hot. I was sweating like crazy. My shirt was just plastered to me by the end. It's really, really muggy. It's a kind of where you just have this gloppy sweat of... Like, if someone took clear glue and just glued bugs across your neck, chest, and forehead. That's what I had today.
Isn't that nice? It's, what, September 8th as we're recording this, and I'm 4 hours from the Canadian border, and it's 90 degrees right now, which is warm for this time of year. And you're probably the same right now, huh?
We're a little cooler. We're like 85, but also with 85% humidity.
It's thick.
Which could be worse.
Could be 30.
See, I'd love cold weather workouts. Now, anyway, my point here is that this is how I look when I'm not used to hard workouts. I get real blotchy and not used to sweating hard and being really hot and gasping for breath. It wasn't supposed to be a super hard workout, but because I'm not in any type of good shape, these moderate hills felt tougher. But there's this phenomenon, Kirk, of when you're out of shape and you do a hard workout, it's tough to get off of the toilet for the next few hours. You ever run into that?
No.
Oh, yeah, me either.
Yeah, continue. I don't run into that specific scenario, but I had this conversation, I'm not going to name their name, this morning, and it's happened in her last two workouts where she's basically stuck to the treadmill, coming back to running after a little bit of a break, and so she outlined that for me nicely this morning.
Oh, that's me right now.
Yeah.
This is week two of training. I was exercising post-surgery. I passed my three, like... medical check marks to make sure that I'm back to be able to handle the full load of training.
Awesome.
And last week I passed that, so I started training, and this is week two, and this is my second, third hill workout. But I ran it a little bit harder today and just churned my guts right up. This is not a poop episode, by the way, ladies and gentlemen.
No, we've done enough of that.
This is a how the out-of-shape body reacts to intensity.
Well, the universe sort of ebbs and flows with who giveth and who taketh. And I think I'm giving my mileage to you because I'm taking a down week. Just needed. It's hit me hard. I'll probably post about it. I don't know yet, but I pulled the plug on a workout on Tuesday and then again, woke up Wednesday, didn't want to run today, only did 45 minutes on the bike and didn't want to do it. Clear sign that all my work is caught up with me and I'm not sleeping enough. You know how it all goes. But I initially had mile repeats at 15% on my calendar, which is a brutal workout, which people don't realize how long that is. It's really a threshold workout. I was going to go 4 reps, mile repeats at 15%, give or take 10-minute reps, you know, 6 miles an hour, let's say.
Question on, are you talking duration of what flat ground miles would be, or are you hitting the full mile at 15%?
The full mile at 15%. So,
which is almost 50% longer.
It's almost twice as long. It actually, for me, it ends up being twice as long. I averaged 4:59 for six mile repeats last week, and it would take me twice as long to do these repeats. Yes. Yeah, so it's really like doing 2 mile repeats on flat ground. It extended. Anyways, you got a call there that's important, Bracken?
Hey, Kirk, it's Austin Alexander. He texted me directly.
But texted you my name?
Yeah. Hey, Kirk, it's Austin Alexander. I've had to make a trip to Camp Pendleton today. ... Don't hate me.
I don't hate you, Austin. So we are supposed to be recording with Austin Alexander right now, if you haven't figured that out. And he didn't show up. So we always have a beautiful Q&A in the hopper, and we have some really good questions. This is what we're going to do today. But, well, I don't hate him. I do hate him. Do you want to publicly say anything?
Only because he thinks I'm you. Which, actually, that might be good. I never get mistaken for you.
Actually, now that I think about it, I am a little upset.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind getting confused for you. You should mind getting confused for me.
That's not true. I can't dunk a basketball.
if they put our pictures side by side on a dating app, what do you think the swipe percentage would be, you versus me? Are we talking 80-20 training here? 90-10 off-season training? What would it be?
I don't know. What are we doing in our photos?
Just sit like we are right now. Just sitting here, portrait.
50-50.
Not a chance.
Yes.
Not for sure. A chance.
You're taller than me. You can jump higher than me.
How many of those things come through in a portrait?
Your eyes are definitely a deeper, more seductive green than mine. You have pronounced eyebrows. You can barely see mine. Mine just disappear into my skin tone. You're not a ginger. Okay, those are a lot of things going for you that I don't have going for me.
How many Instagram followers do you have that are female?
I don't know, like 35,000 or something.
Okay, I rest my case.
That's because you've been a married man since.
Like, I might crush it with the dudes. That's fine, but like, I have a very specific demographic I hit.
This conversation is making me feel weird. There's no appropriate way to respond to this, Bracken.
Like, I can recognize a good-looking man.
Okay, are you? All right. Hard stop.
That's it.
Oh, every time you start on that, I just think you're going to keep buttering me up, but.
No, I'm not going to take it that far.
I was talking about...
I'm not trying to date you actively.
I was trying to talk about my build workout, Bracken.
I got to say that if I were to date a man, he wouldn't have facial hair.
Yeah, that's bad. Well, no, there's a point. You learn this if you were a man with facial hair, and in which the stubble like portion is a death sentence for a woman's face. But once it grows out, you know, a half inch or so, it gets nice and soft, and then it becomes inviting again.
Yeah, I just don't think that if I were to choose a man, I would want facial hair touching me, no matter how soft and luxurious it might be.
What else would you look for in a man, Bracken? If you want to go down this route right now, we can go down this route if this is the direction you're taking.
I think I would have to be the bear. I don't think he could be taller and bigger and burlier than me.
So you'd date a smaller guy.
Yeah. Which would make sense as a heterosexual man. I would want a very feminine man if I were to go for a man. I think that would ease the transition for me.
Anything else high on your priority list here?
I guess I'd want him to look a lot like Lisa.
that's fair.
I think that's probably the type of guy I would go for.
Put long hair on him. Yeah. And he easily could look like a woman.
Yeah, but he'd need to be a pretty one.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
All right.
So just a very attractive, pretty feminine man who's about like 5'3".
Honestly, it sounds a lot like my type too, now that you're outlining this.
Yeah, a little curvy would be okay for me.
All right, anything else?
I mean, I haven't put tons of thought into this.
Yeah.
I think just off the top of my head, that's probably the direction I would go.
All right. Okay. All right, well, I won't make any advances on you at this time.
Yeah, just not without shaving.
Yeah, my bad. Now I know. I know better. So it's been holding us apart, taking that last step in our relationship.
Probably.
All right, guys. If you've put up with this, thank you for still listening.
Where were we? Oh, workouts.
All I was saying is that I abandoned my workout.
Yeah.
I did one rep at 15%, 1 mile, thought about pulling the plug a half a mile in. I was like, this is bad. I wasn't even at goal pace. I knew I was tired, so I started slow and pulled the plug and then improvised, which is something I often recommend doing in a grindy workout that you realize isn't your day. You either pull the plug and move on, or you pivot to efficiency work, which means like short, quick intervals with lots of rest. Which is exactly what I pivoted to. And then it became productive on the efficiency piece still. Even though I wasn't going to be working threshold, I wasn't going to be grinding out there. I shortened them up and got some good turnover going and didn't work too hard. Stayed mentally engaged. And I recommend that to anybody out there who's having a bad workout. And it's like, you know, if you don't want to have a bad day on a tempo run, right? Like if that's going to be your day, like kill it and do some efficiency work. Come back to it next week. So that's what I did this week, Bracken.
Well, here's what I want to hear then. I want to hear how you pivoted, because we get this question a lot. And since this is a Q&A episode, this is a learning episode.
Yep.
Learn me, Kirk. What does a man who last week averaged 4:59 for intervals, you don't like to brag about your running a lot, but I believe you closed in like 4:55, 4:45 your last 2 miles.
With the respect, with staying, I didn't like truly recover. I was running like 7:30 pace for a quarter mile.
Or quarter recovery. Mile at yeah. mid seven paces recovery, mm-hmm. which I wouldn't call the type of recovery needed to do VO2 max intervals. So this was, in theory, slower than 5K pace.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, someone who can do something like that and gets all jazzed up about that workout has their next workout come up and it's not the day to do it. How exactly did you pivot? You said you went shorter with longer rest. I love it, but learn me a little bit here.
Well, you know, rent always comes due, right? And that mile repeat workout sat in my bones a little bit, right, last week. And as it should have, it was a big effort and I swung hard. And then I had to push my long run forward a day because of weekend plans, which bumped from Saturday to, Friday. And I hit a hard 2 hours of hill progressive hill repeats at the ski hill. And didn't feel well, but pushed through. Like, I wasn't ready for that workout, but I wanted to hit it. And so, you know, rent always comes due, right? And I had a feeling like maybe I'm not going to be coming quite around yet. My recovery runs felt okay, so I thought I was fine. But no, as soon as I got into it, I'm like, I can tell why. I know why I feel like crap today. Because I've had the highest mileage weeks I've had recently, and I've stacked them together and had two big workouts last week. Writing was on the wall, so I had a feeling it was coming. So I had an exit strategy already in my head in case. But it's just like it wasn't going to be productive. I was running 5.8 miles an hour on the Nordic track, which what is that? Maybe 6 miles an hour on a regular treadmill, 6.1. Mm-hmm. Something that I should be able to manage easily. And in fact, it was labored. And here was the key, guys. I couldn't get my heart rate up. I was working hard. Like I was like, God, this is awful. And I look and my heart rate's at like 163. And I'm like slogging. And anytime you're working hard and you cannot get your heart rate up, typically is a sign of fatigue. Like my body's so tired, I can't even get my heart rate where I want it. And so I'm like 10 beats a minute under where I should be for this type of effort and it wouldn't rise. And even towards the end, it was just like so much effort to get that heart rate up. And that's when I knew like, hey, that's physiological signs that my body is toast, let alone mentally, I didn't want to be doing it. And so I got done. I was like, just hang on for the first mile and then pivot. And then the exit strategy is always, like I said, short, fast intervals with more recovery. So I took 5 full minutes rest after that interval, licked my wound, said, all right.
Which I like.
I said, let's not rush it. And then I did 60-60 uphill intervals at 15%. Still got almost the accumulated total time, but I broke it up. And it didn't feel awful. It didn't feel great, but it was a way to still get volume in, efficiency work. And I abandoned my plan, but still got something productive that I felt was checking a box without burning myself out. And so that's how I approached it. But the key for me was I couldn't get my heart rate up and I felt terrible in combination and I was trying to sink my teeth into the effort. And anytime you see that, it's not always because you're a wimp. It's because you're actually like, you're so tired, you can't work as hard as you need to. And your body's just putting a governor on you. You'll hear endurance athletes reference that once in a while. Like, I can't get my heart rate up today. Well, that's fatigue generally. Mm-hmm. And so yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, that was exactly what I wanted to hear. And I have two responses to that. The first is that a lot of people, myself included, are like all or nothing type people. I just talked about this with a woman named Cassie that I'm coaching, working with right now, mm-hmm. yesterday about how like don't let the perfect get in the way of the good.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, she's full of these great sayings. I get a lot out of our calls together because she's just a... She's like an old soul. She's got good wisdom, and she seems to be surrounded by people who share good wisdoms with her.
Let's get her on the podcast.
We probably should. And you didn't let the perfect get in the way of the good. Like, your perfect workout didn't exist, and instead of just bailing, you found a good workout. And at the end of the day, you got the same number of reps of hips having to drive forward, the same number of times your heels having to cycle up under your butt under fatigue. You had the same number of times with your arms coming forward and keeping the cadence, the same number of times of your lungs having to pump hard. Like, all those reps still existed. And so someone like me, who likes to let the perfect get in the way of the good, might say, how is that even going to help me? I needed to do 6 to 8 minute reps, maybe even 10 minute reps because of staying power in a race. It's just not going to help me on race day the same amount. Whereas you were able to look at it and say, I'm going to get so many of the same pieces done and I'll also get the workout in.
I didn't want to.
No, but you did.
But I knew it was the right decision. Yeah, that's a good point. And somebody could argue, hey, idiot, just stop the workout. Like, you're doing yourself more harm than good. But in my eyes, I then am going to take that, break it into bite-sized chunks, which is what I did. My heart rate cap was way lower than it would have been for these originally prescribed intervals. And now the remainder of my week, I pivot. So now I say, okay, listen to the cues. And now I'm heavily backing off of all work for the rest of the week. I need a significant deload this week. So I salvaged that workout because I feel good about how I finished it. Then it was like, it served a purpose still, other than just looking back at like a dunce of a workout. And now I listen, now I move forward and take 5 days of relatively moderate and lower mileage work. I might cut my volume in half this week because I can feel I need it. And so I salvaged something and now I react, which is okay to do as well.
Yeah. My second reaction, though, is that I think you can be forgiven a little bit because I think that workout on paper to me looks harder than you thought it was going to be.
Oh, I knew how miserable it was going to be.
Okay. I think it's harder than your flat ground workout. 100%. Because 5.8 miles per hour on 15% works out to 1.45 miles for the treadmill challenge, which on the Nordic track is legit. That's like 1.55 or 1.6 on a non-Nordic track treadmill, or at least our version of the Nordic track. And if you hit 1.55 before Tahoe the year you got 11th, 1.45 is not that much slower than a maximal effort. It's just sub-maximal. And so to hit that multiple times would have been really hard. I would say that that's probably the equivalent of your pace for flat ground. But if your uphill running is self-proclaimed not as good as your flat ground running right now, then that takes it from like five slower than 5K effort to faster than 5K effort. So you're basically trying to do like 5 to 6 by mile at 3K effort.
Yeah, I might have overshot it just a little bit, but my recent 15:15 test was 1:06, almost 6:02, but 1:06:01. It turned
okay.
Turned 1 second afterwards. I was like, you son of a...
1:06:09.
No, it was 1:06:01. It almost went 1:06.
Ooh.
1:06.
That's pretty good, then.
2. Anyways. So I thought it would be, yeah, a lot of work, but I thought I was ready. I was popping. Bang. But anyways, we don't need to dwell on it, but it is good. You're right. It is good lessons learned. And I probably did go out a little too hot for it. I'm sure somebody will benefit, hopefully, from hearing that, right? I think most people think, and I hear this all the time, and I see a couple of pros posting about this now, like, I've lost my fitness, or I have no fitness, or suddenly I'm out of shape. No, you're just tired. Like, I've had this conversation, like, I just ran a workout a week earlier that showed me I was in the best flat ground or best shape I've been in recently. I'm not out of shape. I'm just tired. I'm just tired. Just take a break. Chill a little.
Training is not like racing. You don't tip over in an instant and you're done. There are signs along the way. It takes a few weeks to realize you're overtrained. If a week ago you were popping and this week you're not, you have not lost a thing other than maybe some rest. And it's important to remember, we talk about the media in sports, our what have you done for me lately? But too often we are the same way with our own workouts. What have you done for me lately? I haven't popped a workout in 6 days. I'm done. I'm smoked. Like, I've lost all my fit. No, no, no. You are, what would you say? You are what you did like 15 to 20 days ago. Mm-hmm. So take your rest now. So 15 to 20 days from now, you're back in your fitness. You have not lost your fitness whatsoever. So this is all one rambling, like, I had a tough workout. Who would I date if I were dating a man? Tell me about your workout. All that, the original purpose of this was, if you're one of those people out there who's getting really nauseous or having some GI distress after hard workouts, if you're early in a training cycle, that's just something that happens sometimes. And it usually goes away. It passes within a week or two. I once spent like 10 days or 12 days in college in fall after we started up interval work on the toilet.
The only time I would get something like that is if you, like, hey, want to hop in a 5K for no reason when you're untrained and it's not even like workout effort. It's like, I just literally went to my max heart rate way beyond where I'm prepared for. And then it's like, for hours, you have an upset like race gut afterwards. But that would only be when I'm really unprepared and then I go run out of my gourd hard. Maybe that's what you did this morning.
No, I didn't. I bet I didn't hit lactate threshold one time.
I will also say that when heat is involved and you get that blood shunting and the surface of your skin, that, and you combine that with hard, heavy workouts, that also can lead to GI distress. So you might have the perfect storm. So if you need to leave in the middle of this podcast, just let me know. You can edit that out, of course.
Yeah, but when we switched over from our guest to this recording, I shot over there.
Everybody was curious. Stop. Yeah. Somehow you got to wedge this in here every time.
Not every time.
Just every other time.
Like 80-20.
Well, here, I know 80. Right. We can apply that percentage to a lot of things in our lives. So you're getting us today because, as you heard, our guest who we had scheduled is not here today. And we are going to remedy guests not showing up, I think, in the future. And yes, we have a number of Q&A questions that I always feel good about checking off, and I have fun talking about them. So we're going to do that today.
Can I lead?
I would love that.
Because, I mean, this is long-term planning. I got a question about ultra fueling today, and we have an ultra episode coming up sometime soon, and Race Brain is going to do the Spartan Ultra breakdown, this 24-hour championship breakdown soon. So I want to kick off the festivities with an ultra question. And this is one of those that I got on Instagram, and I didn't feel like using my thumbs to type out this type of response. You and I could do a better job.
That's about most of the time when I push them to Q&As, is like, it's just going to be too long of a response and it warrants a real conversation.
Yeah. Like, you should be paying me at this point for how much time it's going to take me to swipe this thing out.
I agree. Do you have any athletes running the Spartan 24?
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Les Cowan. Les Cowan's prepping for it. He did his first ultra of any sort this year in New Jersey. And he's going after 24.
Sweet. Awesome. I got a few as well.
But he's an animal.
All right.
All right. I'm doing my first Spartan Ultra in October. I've done about 8 beasts, 10 supers, and many sprints, so I have some Spartan race experience. To put that into running terms, beasts are half marathons, supers are roughly 10K, sprints are 5K. So plenty of distance running experience, never done an ultra before. I'm wondering what a good fuel is to eat before my second lap. You see now why I'd rather talk this out.
Yeah. Who is this? I like to give shout outs, or if I know this person.
Daniel B. Nelson.
Okay. All right. Do you want to lead it, or do you want me to start?
Yeah. So I'm going to lead by not answering it. What fuel should I eat? What is a good fuel to eat at the start of the second lap? I believe that thinking of the ultra and the way
Hold
Spartan
on, what ultra, it, are they, it, what ultra are they running? Not the Ultra World
October.
Champs. Okay, this is probably Dallas.
I assume Dallas.
Okay, not the Ultra World Champs.
Yeah. Thinking of an ultra like two beast distances is, I think, a mistake. Because you're not halfway done when you're halfway done. But your fueling is already halfway done. And I'll explain what I mean by that. But mm-hmm. The distance is halfway done when you pit halfway through and do a second lap, but you're really not halfway done with the race. The race gets started somewhere between a quarter and halfway through the second lap. It gets real. So if you're running a 50K, the race really starts somewhere around 30K. And as two guys who have raced hard 50Ks, the wheels start coming off and the race gets real somewhere around 20 to 26 miles. So that tracks. But the fueling, I believe like the halfway point of fueling is halfway through your first lap.
Getting ahead of it.
Yeah, you have to be ahead of it. So even though maybe that wording is inappropriate, you're not halfway through your fueling, you've already hit the critical moment way before your first lap ends. So in a 50K, by the time you're to 25K, you have already missed the boat on fueling. So there are plenty of good foods you could eat at the halfway point, but by the time you get there, your fueling has kind of already been decided for you.
I agree with that. There's a big difference, though, between a 4-hour ultra and a 8-hour ultra as well. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. The amount of time on feed, is this gentleman aiming to run 4 hours, which would be a potential winning time under 5 for a flat Spartan ultra? Or are you going to be out there for half a day? You're going to be out there for 12 hours. Very, very different set of circumstances there as well. So it plays in. And the longer this race gets, the more what you said comes into play. The longer this race gets, like for you time-wise, the more that this comes into play. If it's a 4-hour race and you know that you do well on liquid nutrition and scratch or whatever it is, tailwind, you could probably get away with it if you're going for 4 hours. But you're out there for 6, 8, 12. You're going to need, in my opinion, more than that for blanket advice. So I don't know if you disagree or agree with that, but I would say that I'd say time on feet is relevant to this fueling
Absolutely.
Question.
I think the pit fueling matters more the longer you're going to be out there. So I've run, think, 2 Spartan Ultras and 5 or 6 other Ultras. None of them did my pit feeling matter. The pit was all about getting in and getting back out to racing. I think the one I spent, it was a very fast pit. And when I did the Spartan Ultra, that I DNF'd in Tahoe. So it's funny, it's odd to take my advice on something that I quit about 2 hours after the pit. But I got into it in 5th and I left in 3rd. So I had a fast pit. But I downed some things. I got in there. I immediately switched out my hat, chugged some Perform Elite, and grabbed 2 new bottles and took off. So I actually fueled there by drinking 10 ounces of liquid. That's the most I've ever fueled in a transition zone of an ultra, because I'm trying to finish around 4 hours. My 50K was like 4:12. My ultras are generally, I'm looking to be between 4 and 5 hours. So I don't fuel there because I'm fueling the entire way. I'm sipping probably every 10 minutes. I'm taking a gulp or two of Sustain Elite or Tailwind the entire day. So like, to your point, yes, the pit stop almost doesn't matter. But the longer it goes, the more it's a chance to get some solid food down that you don't have to carry the rest of your day. But either way, I'm a proponent of eat constantly and never stop rather than binge and purge.
If you were to give advice to this gentleman, you had to say, and let's say, well, let's just take, like, most people don't just do liquid nutrition for this whole thing. They're doing gels or chews or real food. Time-wise, where should this gentleman be taking something of substance? Let's say he's planning on running a 7-hour ultra. Let's say 7, somewhere in the middle.
Well, that's, I know what you're trying to get me to do, but I'm going to start by being difficult. I've run 2 6-hour ultras while only having Tailwind.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working at pretty much a maximal effort of what I could maintain. And the second one, I cracked a little bit with 1.5 hours to go, which means I was really on the edge of my effort. So I really do believe that if your stomach likes it and your gut absorbs it, you can just drink for 7 hours. I would do that. I mean, Miguel just did it for a 24-hour ultra with like 50,000 feet of vert. But I think it's just a sliding scale. The moment you think you can eat, you start eating. And the longer it goes, the more dense your options are for what your stomach wants. But this is one of those I would answer with a question of my own, which is, how much have you tested this? I think you start with a drinkable fuel and you keep adding more dense throughout your test runs until you hit your wall. And then you stay under that. And over time, you get better at it and you add more dense. But I don't think what you eat matters as much as how much you get in.
Well, I'm just going to tell you what I think based on knowing absolutely nothing about you. So you have somewhere to start, because you will be practicing this in training, hopefully, at some point. Therefore, I will give you advice. And I agree with everything you're saying, by the way. So
I'm painting broad strokes. You're just going to take a swing at it. And I appreciate it.
I'll take a swing at it. Yep. In the ultra, when you're on your feet for that long, let's go 150 cals, roughly, of palatable fuel every half hour. And I think that you should be having something of substance around the 2-hour mark, which entails maybe, let's say, 300 calories, like a homemade oatmeal bar, a couple of bananas, some really soft, like well-cooked white rice, something that you can just get in, barely have to chew and get down. And then every 2 hours, I think that you refuel with that extra big hit of something very easy to digest. And mix a lot of salt in there too, a salty homemade oatmeal bar. So you're holding on to those, that nutrition or that hydration, and also getting some of that salt in, which you just start to crave later in a race. So if it were me and I were doing it, I would make sure to be getting something of true substance every 2 hours in between my 150 calories every half hour, and make sure it was carb dense, mushy. And I would salt it. Salty and sweet combo would be my blanket statement advice to try. I'm not saying go out on race day and do it for the first time. I'm saying try this in your training first and see how it goes. If you want somewhere to start from, that's what I would say.
Yeah. You're right.
I'm not right.
You're right. That's a good blanket statement. This, I don't know if you can read it. It says ultra fueling. This is what I've learned to be true for me. And this is, a sliding scale.
Hold on. Is this in your notes in your phone or something?
Yeah, this is what I refer back to anytime I start up an ultra block. This is okay. What's worked for me in the past. So broad strokes, 150 to 250 calories per hour, 600 to 900 milligrams of sodium an hour, 17 to 24 ounces of water an hour. Now there's a range there, and the range is based on, is this a 50K or 50 mile? Is this hot versus cold temperature, muggy versus dry, and how hilly is it going to be? The flatter it is, the less likely I am to be able to get a lot in. The hillier it is, the more chances I have on the climb to chug stuff down.
Yep.
Now, if I'm going really long, if I'm talking a 24-hour race, I have it already planned out even though I've yet to run one. So here's what I have planned for a long. We're talking 12 to 24 hours. 17 to 24 ounces plus 150 to 250 calories per hour for the first 2 hours. After that, hours 3 to 4, bump up to 24 to 34 ounces and 300 calories per hour, minimum 60 to 90 grams of carbs. First 2 hours were 30 to 60 grams of carbs. And then start moving into chewing if able. So first several hours are water bottles with electrolyte and calorie mix. Hours 3 and 4, I'm moving into chewables if tolerable. Hours 6 and beyond, add in bars, Uncrustables, baby food. Hours 12 and beyond, anything I can get down. So as it goes, I change how many carbs I want per hour, how many calories per hour, how much water I'm taking in, but it really comes down to what can you get down. So you would need a list like this. If you're going to run an ultra, you need to develop what is your list.
Uncrustables is becoming quite the popular choice. I got an athlete whose Uncrustables are sitting real well with right now, who's running the ultra in Tahoe, the 24-hour.
Those twist-off baby food pouches are fantastic for me. No, Mike Ferguson does them.
You just get sick of sweet after a while. That's where you got to like find your balance, because eventually you're going to want savory, and pretty soon too much sugar will turn your stomach as well. For a lot of people, it does for me. And then it's like, okay, how do I balance that? Like a slice of pizza sounds good right now, but like, what is that going to do to me? It's tough to say.
And you might have to start with heavy bottles early. You're not thirsty, so you're going to have to get calorie-dense bottles early. And as it goes on and you get sick of that taste, you might have to start watering down your bottles with less calorie mix in it and getting more of chewing in. But it's all about you. So test, test, test. But don't rely on the turn. Don't rely on the transition point for your fueling.
Very good advice. You're focusing on the wrong point.
Because then you flood your stomach with blood. And that's bad, bad, bad. And you're behind on calories.
Yep. Have it on you already.
Yeah. Best case scenario, you come into transition and you think, I am so on track. Let's grab and go. You don't want to sit down and think, all right, let's begin.
I agree with that.
All right.
Hard pivot.
Long
here.
Ultra talk. Now let's start clipping along.
I think, they're kind of synonymous with ultras and talking about them nonstop forever. I think it's just going to keep happening. Scott Neth wants to know the juice. Also, question for the Q&A. We hear stories how now and then about the hookup scene in the Olympic Village. Have there ever been rumors of such shenanigans at the Beat Elite House at Tahoe or anything like that? Scott Neth, you dog, you. Bracken?
Listen, the same bell curve of humanity, and I say this all the time, exists in every slice of life. So what you see anywhere else in the world, you're going to see at athletic events, except now the population is higher trained, probably more fit, probably has more testosterone pumping, and is more of an adrenaline junkie. So yeah, take whatever you know to be true about the human race and then multiply it by one or two, and that's what you get. You can't multiply by one. I mean, you can, but you're going to get the same answer. Even I know that. But multiply it by 1.5 or 2. And that's what happens at any athletic competition.
I think what you find in these, and this is some pseudo personal experience or witnessing things secondhand, would be at a lot of these bigger races where people are coming in, whether it's like a national series race or something, there's usually a gathering afterwards. Somebody's got an Airbnb and invites people over, and then there is some sort of like release after this like race where you're, you know, so focused and committed, and then people gather and have drinks and some things may or may not happen. Who knows, depending on the mix of people. And then at the biggest race of the year, like the World Champs or whatever, it becomes a free for all. And I'm not saying these are hookup fests because they are not, but generally you do see that these things sometimes happen because people have been so disciplined and so diligent. And finally they're just like, ugh, I can just relax. I don't even have to care about tomorrow. And when you don't have to care about tomorrow and all you've cared about is tomorrow, is you might feel a little loose. Whatever you want to take that as. Yeah. Simple as that.
That is why I travel and roam with married men or people I trust.
It's fair. That's fair.
Not just married men. Married men that I trust. Gotta have your guardrails in life.
Makes sense that you would room with men, given our conversation.
Married men who I trust keep their mouth shut. Right. Just joking, obviously.
Ooh, Brandon Waters says, good morning, sir. I have a request or question that could be a possible topic for a Q&A for TRP or possibly a deep dive. A while back, I asked about what heavier runners should do, like Clydesdale Athena. Bracken answered with, don't do what the pros do and everything costs more, which I 100% agree with. But what I am wondering is what should training and racing look like for us? Do we just do everything the same but with lowered expectations due to our size? Or should we approach our training a little differently? Also, what would our theoretical ceilings be at distance running? We certainly aren't going to get anywhere near the Kipchoge, Ingebrigtsen, Cheptegei, Bekele levels. Studied person here with throwing these name dropping. So what would be considered elite for our category? Where is our theoretical ceiling at each standard distance? Just a thought. Love the show. Keep up the great work. It's a lot to unpack there.
Well, I have great news for everyone who is not tiny and light. The Clydesdale world records are faster than 99% of us will ever run.
Why don't we talk about that? Submit some examples.
Well, Seb Conrad is a runner over in Europe. He's done some OCR. He took top three or four at Spartan 24-hour championships in Iceland and did something like 400 burpees, mm-hmm. something like that. Just an animal. He weighs, I want to say, around 190 pounds, which isn't massive by the general population's scale, but it's very big for a runner.
Isn't Clydesdale 200 for men and Athena is 170 for, I don't know, what is it?
185, 180, somewhere around in there. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I'm going to get to why his example matters. First of all, I think he's run 1350 something in a 5K at 190 some pounds. He also put on a 10 pound vest to get over 200 pounds and broke the marathon record. I think he ran like 232 or something
with
like
a vest
that. With a 10-pound vest on to get over 200 pounds. So point is, unless you think your ceiling is 1350 or 232 in a marathon, you don't have to worry about what is my ceiling as a heavier athlete, because it's going to be just fine. Mm-hmm. There are guys running sub-14 who are considered Clydesdale athletes. Not a lot of them, but none of us are going to be Kipchoge or Bekele anyways. None of us are going to be within minutes of them, most likely. So we don't even have to worry about that. So the good news is your ceiling is just fine. Start with that.
Listen, compared to Bekele or Kipchoge, I'm 5'10", 172 pounds, butt naked in the morning, right? I am a Clydesdale comparatively to these people you're comparing yourself to, right? Like those people are what is a Kipchoge? He's probably, 5'9", 130?
I would say under on both of those.
5'8", 125, maybe. I'm a monster comparatively. Maybe you feel like a monster compared to me at 5'10", 172, but it is perspective. There are levels to this whole body image thing, and you're right. There are absolutely no ceilings. I often feel like I'm defying what I should be able to do for my size, and you can also defy what you should be able to do for your size, mm-hmm. however big you are asking this. You asked about training specifics, how it impacts your racing. What it does, what we mean like don't do what the pros do, it means like don't wear the lightweight 5-ounce shoes to go run a marathon. Like, yes, Kipchoge can get away with that, but you cannot. Like, and Kipchoge, I suppose, wears the Alpha Flies, but you get the point. Like, so first of all, gear is going to be massively different for you. Footwear more than anything is going to be different. So you're going to need something that gives you something back and absorbs a little more impact because your ground force is just higher. So the first thing is like, you cannot take shoe advice from the Kipchoges of the world. You need to just start your own trend there. And then two, your impact force is higher, so it may take you longer to recover if you're running hard or fast, maybe. But I have 200-pound athletes who are running 60 miles a week right now without a problem. Actually two of them now that I think about it. So Body adapts. Mm-hmm. I just think, like, I don't think you should put governors on yourself at all. The only thing that I go right to is, like, footwear. What the pros are wearing versus what you are wearing are probably going to be massively different and should be. Where does your head first start with that?
It's the exact same thing. I don't think you change anything other than, well, really nothing. You don't change anything because everyone has to listen to their body. And that establishes what you can currently handle. And then you proceed like any other athlete out there, which is when I feel like I can handle more, I add more in. And when my body is starting to bark at me, I back off a little bit. I would start to say that prehab and rehab maybe matters more because you're putting more wear and tear on certain areas of your body. But it could be argued that it matters just as much to a super light, frail athlete who spent no time in the weight room and is really fragile. So I don't think you have to do anything different. You just have to be in tune to your body. But more than anything, you have to stop comparing yourself. And I say this all the time, but everything is relative. Let's say you're a 220-pound man. Like, man, if I could just weigh 190, how fast would I be? Well, there are a bunch of people out there who'd said, man, if I could just weigh 220, think of how fast I would be. Like, everyone is someone else's goal endpoint. But you never feel like the goal endpoint. You always see someone else. So you have to get rid of comparisons. Like they say comparison is the thief of joy for a reason. It truly is. It sucks the life out of whatever you're doing. You cannot enjoy it if you're always comparing yourself to someone else. You should have a dartboard up there. People you want to go after, things you want to do, but you can't look at them and say, oh, if I could just be them, I would be happy or fast, because that's not the reality.
Preach, brother. I could not agree more. But I think, oh, go ahead.
Well, I'm going to say right now I'm 180 pounds. Mm-hmm. When I was at my best at Spartan Race, I was 167. What am I doing differently in training right now? When I write out my training plan, what am I doing differently? Nothing. I'm starting at maybe slightly lower volume because this extra 13 pounds seems to be wearing on me a little bit more. I get a little bit more sore after downhill work.
And you're and 6 years older. Running.
Yeah. So what am I doing? Instead of starting at 60-mile weeks, I'm probably clipping into 45 or 50 pretty soon here.
So age plays into this more than body weight. If you want to try to pivot what you're doing based on one of it or the other, if you're a 25-year-old, 250-pound man, freaking go nuts. But if you're a 45 or a 55-year-old, I would just point, I think age would be more of a factor in putting governors on yourself than body size. It yeah. sounds kind of crazy to say, but I believe that.
Well, and for most people, unless you've done years of damage to the internal workings of your body, or if you have some sort of medical anomaly, most people, if you approach your training systematically and do progressive overload, your body weight will change. In some regard, it's going to change for the positive, unless you've done a lot of damage with weight fluctuations and your homeostasis is all out. But you will not be able to change your body's age. So I think that just verifies what you're saying. Like, if you do train and take it seriously and train with the intensity and the specificity of a pro and just discard trying to be 125 pounds, you're going to lose weight as you go, but you won't get younger. So just train following all the principles we espouse on here and you're going to be fine.
Yeah, you want to know what your ceiling is? Why don't you go find out?
Yeah.
Next question, Trevor Logsden. Previous athlete of mine, Trevor. I believe he's on the Running Public training plan now. For the everyman who is trying to balance life and the increase of weekly volume, does mowing the lawn count? In all seriousness, with a walk-behind mower, it takes me 2.5 to 3 hours to mow my lawn, and I get just shy of 9 miles while doing so. I want and don't want that yard.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are others out there with large yards that might be push mowing. Is it safe to count these miles towards weekly volume and consider it low impact recovery work? Love that question. That is not a silly question. Love that question.
I think the way to answer that is to take the mower away and said, if I went out for a 9 mile weighted walk, would I count that as training? And if you wouldn't count going for a relatively slow walk with some resistance training, then you don't get to count the mower. If you're training for a 5K, it's probably not training. If you're training for an ultra and you're going to spend a lot of time walking under duress, that's probably training. But most likely what it is it's bulletproofing. It's time on feet. It's spending 9 miles on your feet, having to use all the supporting structure of your body. And it's just going to make you a little bit more durable.
Active recovery, which could count.
Active recovery.
Could or could not count. Recently, I have been going on multiple hikes per day over the weekend, checking out different pieces of public property in Minnesota and Wisconsin. I'm accumulating anywhere from 4 to 8 miles on feet after my morning workout. And I find that it actually, I'm feeling like I'll wake up the next day feeling even looser and better. It's almost like my body charged up. It's weird. Like you go run for 2 hours and then I go do a 4 or 5 miles of hiking through thick crap in the Wisconsin woods and it's sweaty and gross and I get worked up and I'm kind of tired, but I wake up the next day to go for a run and my body's like, you know, an object in motion wants to stay in motion, an object at rest wants to stay at rest. And it's just like, felt like it worked some kinks out. So in a sense, like I'm not counting these hikes as training, but I feel like it is impacting my training in almost a positive way. And so either way, I would look at it as a net gain for some reason. It's not benefiting you. How is it exactly benefiting you? I don't know, but there's things to keeping the fascia loose, keeping the muscles moving, getting out there in hot weather and sweating your balls off, loosening everything back up like that counts for something, right? And just as you said, if you're out there training for 6+ hour events, like you can start arguing this is relevant time on feet.
Yeah. Does active recovery make you more fit? No. It gets you more prepared for the next workout that moves your fitness. And that is an important thing to remember. So do you really need to count volume of active recovery? You should track it so that you can see trends, but I don't add walking mileage to my running mileage, but it doesn't mean I don't need it. If I go and power hike on the treadmill, I don't add my miles, but I'll add my vert to the week. But I know that the next day I'm ready to rock rather than working through the stiffness in the workout.
The more you move easy, the quicker you seem to recover, which is confusing for some people. I recently had a conversation with one of my athletes, Natasha Manziel, who we've had on this podcast as a guest. And we moved her to doubles twice or three times a week. We did this over a month ago, and she is feeling better than she ever has. We've increased her mileage by 25% on her intuition, saying, I want to try this. Me saying it makes sense. And she's just recovered for all of her dang quality sessions when you would think, well, Christ, she's running twice a day, 2 or 3 times a week. That's only going to fatigue her more. But you've alluded to this, Bracken, when your time in Colorado, every time you slip on those running shoes and go out, as long as it's slow, easy work, it's just like bumping up your recovery process. Now, Natasha's run 60, 70 mile weeks, and she's built up the ability to do that. Mm-hmm. However, like moving your body more, just almost at a low grade, and Natasha's really good at running her recovery runs very easy, even easier than she needs to, really. Well, it just prepares you better to rip when you're ready to go again. And there's like a lot of power in moving your body in that way to prepare for your next one. I remember in high school, I baled and mounded hay for my uncle. I got paid $5 an hour and he fed me dinner. That was the real catch there. And I'd work all day sweating my butt off. These things are, you know, 70 to 90 pound bales of hay up in the loft, which is super hot. And we'd have this big water cooler and we'd just be dying. I wouldn't run that day. And I would get home, you know, eat food, go to bed, wake up, and I'd have to push my run to Sunday, for example. We'd always mound and bale hay on a Saturday. And every time my Sunday run, I would just fly my long run. I'd be like, I'm going to be fatigued today, all that stuff I did yesterday. And then I'd go and pop like 10 out of 10 times. I couldn't figure it out. And now I'm just realizing in hindsight, like I was just actively recovering and moving my body and everything was loose and ready to go. Yeah, there was some stiffness the first 5 to 10 minutes of my run, but things were ready to go. I think you could translate that to anything you're doing.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a roundabout way to get at that point, but I noticed it.
Well, we're also talking about something else that is important. Part of these Q&As is they stimulate a different line of thinking that is important for people to remember. And that is that you've got to get your crappy feeling out somewhere. Part of what doubling used to do for me when I doubled more is I'd feel crappy on my morning run, but I was going to feel crappy on my next run no matter what. So I'd just dog it. I'd go slow. I'd get it out of the way and I'd crack off an evening run rather than get my bad run there and have to wait till the next day to get something good. I just saved a day in the process by getting something out of the way that was going to feel a little crappy. And I told a story a few weeks ago about when I raced Luke Rutz in that mile around our state capital, and I ran like 420 or 421. I'd been roofing all weekend.
Yep, exactly. That reminds me of that.
Yeah, this is July in Wisconsin, so it's 90s and humid, and I'm on a roof with my dad doing the garage. And I wasn't going to go to the race, and the race was at 1 p.m. And at 11:30, I said, oh, And he said, just do it. I jumped off the garage. I took a shower. I drove to Madison. I warmed up for 15 minutes and I ran 4:21. Mm-hmm. I felt so terrible in my warm up. I wanted to just leave. But then I was loose. There's something to be said about being really loose.
Sure is, just like those after parties.
I will say this. If you're training for an ultra, this is your time to do barefoot work. This is your time to do weight vest work. Throw on a weight vest, go with a minimal shoe or barefoot, and push that mower. That is sports specific. That builds up some actual staying power that you will need late in the race.
Throw a 50-pound pancake on top of that lawnmower. Go to town. Yeah.
I worked with a guy named Josh Cook on and off for some years, and his best World's Toughest Mudder and Killington performance came the summer when he switched to a manual mower on his several-acre property, and he mowed barefoot with a weight vest on. Hours per week. Manual mower. And with that thing, you can run behind it. Now you get an actual working. Mm-hmm.
I would tell Trevor that look at it as active recovery setting you up really nicely for whatever's next. And just pat yourself on the, whether you want to count it for mileage or not, I think it's only going to benefit doing something like that. A strategic double. But I only think it's increasing your recovery potential for what's coming next, not damaging it. And that's what I think is important. People get that mixed up sometimes. And again, if you're deconditioned and you haven't been moving your body much at all, it's a different case, but not in Trevor's case, because I know Trevor. I see you're looking at your phone. Did you want to get to one or?
Yeah, I got one here.
Okay.
I'm wondering what distance or type of race are appropriate to wear a hydration pack. When should I start feeling comfortable enough not to need one, and at what distance? Just for trail runs, how about a road half marathon? Appropriate or not? I realize this is personal preference, but at what health and fitness level should one be able to feel hydrated, fit enough to not need one?
Who asked that question? We got to know who these people are.
Well, this is a screen name, Ohio Bread.
Nice.
It's not a person's name, so I just was going to leave it out, but Ohio Bread. B-R-E-D, not like bread, like breadsmith. I think that's important to clarify.
They're very different. Wow.
It's going to change your entire athletic life.
It really is.
Not like it changes your life, but throughout your athletic life, this answer will change every few months.
If it's your first road 5K and it gives you peace of mind, strap that sucker on your back and go. Yeah. But here, no matter what the conditions are, in my narrow scoped opinion, being like I've lived life through my own eyes, no matter the conditions, even in a 100-degree day, 45 minutes or less, there's no need for anything. In my opinion.
Yeah.
Maybe a half hour if it's an extreme, extreme case. But I will say that I do not, this is just again me, if I'm running a race that's circa an hour to hour 15, I am typically not getting, unless it's an extreme hot temperature, I am not swinging by the water station unless it's to dump it over my head to cool me off. Maybe a sip, but you can go an hour 15. I've been doing my 2-hour long runs without a sip of water recently. I don't know why. I've just been enjoying this fasted dry state. So I would look at it more time than distance. Physiologically, unless it's extreme heat, you should be able to go an hour at a race effort without touching water, let's say 70 degrees or less, without it impacting your performance. That's not science. That's anecdotal. But I think
also
it's
science.
Well, I don't know what the science says exactly, so I don't want to be like quoted on that or quote somebody on that. But that's just like generalizations. Hour or less, let's say 70 degrees or less, something like that, I find like go rip, you're going to be fine without impacting your performance. But if you lose confidence and you're like, I need water, I'm getting dehydrated, and suddenly it gets in your head because this is a heady thing we do, this running sport. Mm-hmm. Frick, I don't care. Wear the dang thing. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it's just like ultra fueling. You just got to know your body. Someone like Tim Lambiris, for example, is a super heavy sweater. If I sweat like him, I would be bringing water on races up to starting at probably 40 minutes.
Okay.
Because the science shows like you start to decrease performance right around once you lose 4% of your body weight in dehydration. Now, it starts out small. The reduction in performance is very small, from like 4% to 7%. And then once you get over 7, things start to really ramp up. But you can lose 4% of body weight without really impacting performance. So it comes down to, what is your sweat rate? How fast do you lose 4%?
Think about that. 150-pound athlete can lose 6.5 pounds of water before it you even notice a negative impact in mm-hmm. your performance, if all other factors are still looking good. That's incredible. That's way more than we think.
Yeah, you don't need to finish your run at the same amount of hydration you started with. If mm-hmm. that were the case, you would have to carry 6 pounds of water with you in order to stop those 6 pounds of leaving. You don't need to. You just need to staunch the bleeding. That's mm-hmm. all that needs to happen. So, I mean, there are some conflicting studies on this. And most recently, they started to show that it's a little less detrimental to be a little dehydrated than you would think. But 60 to 75 minutes is really my cutoff, depending on how hot it is. But it changes based upon my fitness. A year when I was living in Colorado, training big volume, preparing for Tahoe, I went and raced the Hawaii Spartan Beast, which was around 14.5 miles, back-to-back days, and didn't carry anything. I didn't carry water. I didn't carry fuel. And I did just fine. I drank maybe 2 cups of water at aid stations day one and was really feeling it because I was working hard the second half. And the second day, I probably had the same amount and felt just fine because I worked submaximally that day. But if it were a harder race, I probably would have carried a 10-ounce bottle. It would have been just fine for 2.5 hours of racing. But I was very fit and used to training at high altitude where you dehydrate very quickly. Mm-hmm. So now, in this day and age, the last Spartan Beast I ran, I carried my Nathan Peak with 17 ounces of water mixed with Sustain Elite. No, it would have been Tailwind in the back. And I felt that 3/4 of the way through, I was having to be really, really critically thinking about how I doled out my water because I was running out and I could have just used more and more and more. Mm-hmm. So it's almost that your fitness determines more than anything else, which is why early on, take more. Who cares? You're probably not near your ceiling anyway, so what's another pound of water going to do? And as you get more fit, you find out what you actually do and don't need.
Yeah, look at it time versus distance too, like duration versus distance. So trying to learn what your body does at certain time stamps versus distance stamps, and then predicting how long you'll be out there, and then understanding, yes, I can rely on a cup or two of water out there on course at an aid station, or no, I need more in between. I think what I wanted to get at is we need less than we think. I'm not promoting being dehydrated by any means. Nope. And once you tip over, it can get really ugly, especially in super hot conditions. But most people have that, it's not like a nervous tick, but it's like you said, if you have a bladder and a little sucky tube, once you start taking it, you always are feeling like, I need a little more. I need a little more. And you're suddenly in this habit of oh, my mouth's dry. I need more water. I must be dehydrated. Well, yes, you're constantly being slowly dehydrated during these races. But as you said, if that were the case and we performed worse as we lost water, we'd start out at our best and we'd slowly just get worse and worse as the race went on. And that's not the case. It's not how our bodies work. We store a surplus of water in our cells in order to be able to do what we do. And so there's more in there than you think. I don't know. We could dive way more into that, but I think that's enough. Do you?
I do want to address his what's appropriate question.
Okay.
Because this is kind of a sticking point of mine. You'll hear these brash statements. Real runners don't listen to music. Real runners don't wear compression shorts under split shorts. Runners don't wear camelbacks. No. Runners follow the entire spectrum. And what's appropriate for running is what's appropriate for you. I don't care what you wear. I don't care how much you hydrate. I don't care what you listen to or if you don't listen to. I don't care if you wear super shoes or not, as long as you're comfortable with it. You should wear exactly what makes you comfortable. That all you got to look good to feel good to run good, that matters. And what makes you feel confident and what makes you just feel prepared for the effort, that's the appropriate thing to do. So I don't think anyone should ever second guess, oh, I'm wearing a fanny pack at this race. Who cares? If I were to go out and run a half marathon right now, I would probably wear a waist belt with a 10-ounce soft flask in it. Mm-hmm. Because 10 ounces of water is never going to change your performance in terms of weight weighing you down. But that with a gel mixed up inside of it, taking that 40 minutes in will change your performance for the better. So I wouldn't care.
I would say mechanically, a waist belt hydration, impacts less your biomechanics and how you feel about mm-hmm. just your upper body carriage than a vest or a backpack hydration pack, I would say if you're looking to like play it safe, that waist belt, you can put 16 ounces of water in it, go roll, no problem. You won't even notice it's there once you get rolling. Once you strap something over your shoulders, it starts to affect your gait a little bit. So I would veer people, if you're on the fence, stick one around your waist, you're going to be just fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, this is an email. So this is very official. Blake Thomas Jenkins. Hello, Bracken and Kirk. This is to both of us. First off, I love your podcasts and listen to them often. I am a relative newbie to serious running. I have ran on and off my whole life, but the last couple of years I've started training and racing. Love your podcast. I'm grateful for the sound advice. Question time. Does running downhill improve your stride? When going relatively steep downhill, dirt road steep, not Utah beast steep, I can open up my stride length, but does that equate with repetition to an improved stride? And two, well, let's start with one at a time. They're two very different questions now that I'm looking at it. So let's answer this one quick. Does downhill running improve your stride?
I'm going to sound like Richard Diaz. Running well downhill improves your stride. Running crappy downhill does not improve your stride.
Well said. Running downhill improves your turnover and can be good for just teaching the legs to turn over and around faster, because gravity is going to help you do that. So it is good for biomechanical work. I'm going to say it does not improve your stride. It improves your turnover. In fact, I would argue that uphill running significantly improves your stride more than downhill running. But uphill running does not improve your turnover. In fact, it typically damages it, whereas downhill running improves your turnover. So I think both are needed. Downhill running is turnover work in disguise. And I think that's the main thing. But I don't think it teaches good stride biomechanics or habits, like inherently.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
In order to run fast downhill, you have to run well. Yep. You're just flailing and thrashing. You're going to hurt a lot, but you're probably not going to be your fastest. But if you run well downhill, you're really using your core and your hips and your glutes. And those things are really necessary to run well with a good stride on the flat ground. So yeah, I think I'm getting redundant at this point, but if you run well doing one thing, it will help you run well doing something else.
I will tell you what, the more uphill work I do, the more efficient I feel running on flat ground. But if I do a bunch of downhill work, it doesn't make me feel efficient running on flat ground, but it is a skill that I feel like sharpens itself. Downhill running sharpens downhill running, but it doesn't necessarily translate a lot to other areas, just in my personal experience, other than teaching your body to turn over if it doesn't come naturally to you.
It can make you faster, but it may not make your stride better.
Yes. Question two, junk miles. Is there such a thing as junk miles, where they have no benefit to your fitness and overall running ability? On one hand, it increases your volume and therefore increases your efficiency. And on the other hand, lots of slow miles can shorten your stride and reduce your running effectiveness. Should I go on runs where I'm not feeling it just to get miles in for the week? Sort of the question. Thank you, Blake Jenkins.
I'm going to repeat my answer. If you are running well, if you are using proper mechanics and running intentionally, there is no such thing as a junk mile, and I think I will die on that hill. There's no such thing as junk miles. The only way running long and slow slows your stride or deforms it is if you're not doing quality work or stride work along with that in your week. If you went out and ran 13-minute pace for 200 miles a week, yeah, your stride's probably going to be worse. But that's because you took out important things and replaced them with slow running. If you keep the important things and add in as much as you want to slow, it will in no way, shape, or form hurt your stride. You just have to run well.
Blanket statement, no, there are no such thing as junk miles. Unless you are having to bide your time coming back from injury, managing time on feet, and it is exactly what Bracken said, replacing time where you should be spent doing purposeful work. Mm-hmm. Going back to our principle about moving your body is recovery. Junk miles can serve a great purpose. I've been running what some would classify as junk miles with my girlfriend Jess on like a Sunday once in a while, and it's very low heart rate, slower than I would go, serving no real purpose, but yet then I feel great the next day for my next run. I'm running with a very efficient short stride. It's not like I'm really opening up my biomechanics, but it's moving, you know, an object in motion wants to stay in motion, whatever that motion is. If it's junk miles or mowing the lawn, my heart rate might be the same for both. I don't know. But all I know is that if you subscribe to that principle, I don't think there are junk miles if you're staying healthy and it's not compromising your quality work, meaning it's not replacing it, just like you said. So I don't know what else I have to add to that other than I don't think there's junk miles. I used to think there was. Now I don't think there are.
The further you get from the track, the less you believe in junk miles.
Yep.
And the reason we used to think that is because we thought that only pace mattered. If junk miles made you slower, so would cross training. Elliptical would make you worse. Biking would make you worse. Swimming would make you worse. Going for a walk would make you worse. There are people who will argue all those things. You bike too much, it's going to slow down your cadence. Well, yeah, if you don't do any fast cadence work. But if you're doing fast cadence work as well, it's just going to help you.
Johnny Lunalima. And he's coming back around to old form, it looks like, which is great to see. In his breakout year in Spartan, where he won two U.S. National Series races, dude was biking like 8 hours a week and running like 10. The guy was biking hundreds of miles a week and winning U.S. National Series races for the first time in his life, and he was winning them convincingly. I don't think biking slowed Johnny down, now did it? But it didn't take away from his running, and that was the key point there. You got another one you want to ask?
No, you go next. I'll save this one.
Chloe Conlon. Conlon. Chloe says, could you guys maybe do a future episode on tape? Well, let's see if where we get here. We'll read it anyways. Could you guys maybe do a future episode on tapering and recovery between races and after hard efforts? I listened to your tapering versus deloading episode, but maybe another one focused more on big races. Marathon, 50K, 50-mile distances. Covering when you're stop lifting weights. I think she means you. Carb loading, sleep, non-running exercises in the taper. Then a recovery piece. How many days, weeks off running do you suggest after? Other forms of exercise in the recovery period. When to resume weightlifting and how to race back-to-back big efforts and what to do in between. I did listen to your episode on racing back-to-back, but maybe a refresher on, say, racing a 50K, then a 50-miler 2 weeks later, then a half marathon, da-da-da-da. Those are just what I did and wondering if I did things right and where to improve. Recovery and tapering are hard. Thanks. Now, I will follow this up with saying that was a lot, and it was also very, very good because oftentimes people might have a Spartan beast and then have a marathon 2 weeks later and want to navigate those 2 weeks in between big type efforts. There is a place for us to cover that. It's not right now. I think it's going to warrant a full episode, as she alluded to. What do
or
you
a
think?
Seminar.
Yeah, or a like, seminar.
Or a book.
Or a That's, book.
That is all legitimate real life circumstances, and we can't cover that in like 5 minutes or less here, but they're great questions, and yeah, they probably we just need an ultra like series prepping for an ultra, racing your ultra, fueling an ultra, recovering from an ultra, recovering in between ultras, something like
that. You
know
what, we're going to be getting to what we call the off season, and I really like doing an ultra series and then like a run your fastest 5k series, doing polar opposites where we cover the bases. But she is right, Chloe. We did not cover, we covered how to do back-to-back race weekends where you're running multiple races in 1 week. We talked about recovery versus deloading, tapering versus recovery, all that. But we have not talked about big races separated by like a week or two and how to navigate that. We didn't specifically cover that. So I'm going to save this one because I think we should at some point.
Easy answer, bad answer, treat it like fueling and test it out a bunch in training. Just like finding a taper is difficult, finding the recovery for you is difficult. Because there's Chris Roglosky's in the world and there's people like me in the world who need entirely different recoveries post big races. But yeah, we should hit this. Let's do a series.
Chloe, the question is great. It's so great that you're going to leave unsatisfied because we're not answering it today, but we will hit this coming up. Thank you for the idea.
All right.
Oh, you got one?
Oh, yeah. No. Do it. You're rolling.
Colin Lee.
That's the one I had.
Hi guys. Hope you're both well. Is that how it starts?
Got a suggested for a training Tuesday.
You go nuts.
You want to read it together?
Okay. 1, 2, 3.
You mentioned a few times.
Go ahead. That was going to be awkward real quick.
You've mentioned a few times about having a block of downhill training to bulletproof your legs and that this stays with you for a period of time. What would that block look like? Duration of block, how many times per week to do the downhills, tips for downhill training without access to big mountains or hills, workout suggestions, any supplementary strength work. I believe we have downhill training as an episode, and I think we have preparing for hills if you don't live in the mountains. So definitely start by going and checking those two episodes out, but we'll also give you a little overview here.
Yes, we will. Go ahead.
Have you done a downhill specific block ever?
No, but I've made very purposeful points of time in my training to not neglect them, meaning find a way every week to run fast and hard downhill. But that's not what I would consider a block.
True. Because you never let it go, so you didn't have to fully do it. You've done more uphill blocks to prep for races. Someone who's come off injuries several times now. I mean, you have two, but I spent some of my rehab time building in blocks of downhill work. So what I found is best for me, and I've done this with other people, but for me is to do a midweek skill downhill in a long grindy downhill on the weekends. And I do that for up to 6 weeks. You probably will find your own version of that. You might be able to do 6 or 8 weeks, but you might not be able to do the big downhill every single week. So here's how my 8 week, let's call it an 8 week downhill block would look, or 6 week. It really doesn't matter. Week A, you are on your weekend, you're doing a big, long, moderate downhill. So this would be more like fire road descents or something more gradual, maybe some single track that's flowy, and you're just doing longer reps where, like, for example, the hill workout I did today is like this. It's 0.81 miles of switchbacks that are not very steep, anywhere from 5 to 10% grade, and just flowing it down at a comfortably fast pace. I work my way up, flow my way down, work my way up, flow my way down. Got like 2,000 feet of descending, I think, or 1,300 feet of descending, somewhere in there. But it wasn't super damaging. And next weekend, go to your big, whatever your biggest, nastiest hill is, and you go up easy and rip down. Go up easy, rip down. And this is what I did last weekend, until your legs are ready to be done. And then you go up hard and pick your way down for the rest of your time. So alternating week A and week B with flowy trails and nasty hard descents. And then in the middle of the week, I do downhill training skill work intervals, where I went to a hill. This was at Alpine Valley, and I started 50 meters from the bottom of the hill. And I did the 50 most perfect meters of downhill running I could, and then decelerated and slowly walked back up and then went back down. And I did it until I couldn't do it with the correct form anymore, or until something on my body started to bark at me. I think I did 6 reps week one, and I slowly built it up to 75 meters, 100, until the end I was doing a 350 meter descent at the exact same pace I was doing 50 meter descents to start, and my body felt more stable and comfortable throughout, and I was doing like 7 of those. So that was my downhill block. I did skill work midweek, grindy work on the weekends, and alternated hard and massive efforts of that downhill work.
I like it. I have recent perspective on this. So. Okay. I have been recently hitting downhills with some purpose every other week. So 14 days apart during a long run. And what that's doing is I'm managing okay, but every 2 weeks I'm realizing I'm beat up for 2 days. Like, my hips are sore. My everything is real sore for a few days afterwards. And so I'm realizing that wedging a downhill in between is very important. So your strategy of twice a week hitting downhills in some capacity is important, because once a week I'm just going up on my incline trainer, no descending. And then once a week I'm hitting real terrain. So I'm only getting descending potentially once, and I've only been hitting them hard every other week when I'm on real terrain. Realizing that is not enough because of how much it beats me up. Now, I could maybe get away with it and perform okay, but the damage afterwards has been very notable, like so stiff for 2 days. And so I think at very minimum it's that, but more often the better. Just get going downhill with purpose once per week, I think, is a good building phase. And then once per week with the skill work like you talked about. Now, what I'm shifting towards doing, and I did this last week and I really enjoyed it, I've done it twice now, is let's say you want to get some quality work done on a hill. You go and you hit your metabolically stimulating uphill repeats hard, like as hard as you want, go nuts. You're going to get whatever you want out of your hill work. And then afterwards you can recover and then you can go up the hills. Like, for example, I'm doing this in the middle of my long runs. Then after I get, let's say, my 10 to 20 decently spicy hill repeats in, then I'm basically power hiking up and ripping down, power hiking up, ripping down, because at least I got my metabolic work done. And then I'm going to go create damage, which is not going to affect my uphill running, which we need to train both because racing, you need to run uphill after running downhill. But the point is you can always end with downhill finishers and they're not going to impact what you've done beforehand. And so anytime you are chasing vert or doing anything like that, go ahead. You're back, Bracken. You just froze a little bit.
Just popped up and said my Wi-Fi is unstable.
Nah, you're good now. You froze for a second.
Not even on Wi-Fi.
Well, that would be why it's unstable. Point being is these downhill finishers after the majority of your work is done, like let's say you want to climb your mountain, local mountain hard, turn around and rip it, go ahead. I'm just realizing that once every other week hard is not enough, and even sprinkling in a few hard efforts in there at some points is going to go a long way. So, and then I think if you're looking for the other ancillary pieces, go back and listen to like our Training for Mountains Without Mountains episode. That will fill in the gaps there much more thoroughly than we can right now. Mm-hmm.
So then the second half of that question, and I guess to reiterate, form matters early. It is better to do good reps early than bad reps and more of them. It is important to stop when you can't run well down the hill anymore.
How do you know? How do you know if you're running well downhill or not? How do you know?
I think you have to have some cues. You have to have a foot plant cue. You have to have some arm cues, and you need some hip or chest cues. If you're really leaning back and braking, you know the difference between your feet move faster, they move faster, and then you start taking some break steps in there. When the break steps start happening early on, the rep is done. And that's why I was starting at 50-meter reps. Because most people can make it 30 to 50 meters with no downhill skill, getting faster and faster, and then they hit the oh shoot button and I've got to stop. That's where the rep stops. And you slowly push that out. So I think it's important. I have cues of trying to get my feet landing as close to center mass as possible, having my hips tucked underneath me and not really push forward or back, and having my chest having some semblance of lean to it. The steeper it is, the harder it is to lean downhill, but we all know the difference between working down the hill and fighting the hill. So at worst, that's your guiding light is, am I working down this hill? Am I flowing this hill? Or am I trying to resist the hill?
Makes sense.
So early on, I think it's important to prioritize running it well so that as you build fitness up, you can do it more and more and more. And then once you can't run it well anymore, I think a great stimulus is chopping your feet and kind of what you would consider breaking downhill, like going down a Black Diamond ski slope or going downstairs where you're just doing choppy little steps, but you do it with the fastest feet possible. You don't need any form to do that correctly. You don't need any fitness to do that correctly. You just have to consciously force yourself to get your feet off the ground as fast as possible, even if you're only doing 6-inch strides. And you can build up a ton of eccentric damage that way, which will pay off when your skill catches up to it. And now you can pair the two together.
I like that.
Then, how often do you have to revisit this to stay on top of it? That's the question for most people who aren't doing the John Albin of, I race in the mountains, so I live in the mountains every single day or most days. What is my minimum effective dose of this so that I can get back to a mountain race training as quickly as possible without having to redo this?
Well, I think the thing to answer is, well, let's say like for my example, like I've been doing it roughly every other week, but then it's kind of trashing my legs for like 2-3 days afterwards, rendering me less effective until I can get back to it. And so you have to say like, how often can I do this to the point in which now after my sessions, I'm still not wrecked and I can resume training how I want to. So for me, I'm realizing I need to probably run downhill with purpose every week. But every other week needs to be like maybe a sole focus, lots of volume with it. And then every other week can be sort of maybe lower volume. There's other pieces to my workout that aren't downhill focus, but one every other week, full downhill focus. And then the other week, it still needs to be in there in some capacity where you're opening it up, working hard, even if it's for shorter durations. I don't think once every other week is enough in the sense that recovering from that becomes more difficult. Maybe you could perform in a race well. You could, you know, once every other week might be enough to go race hard, run hard downhill, still be able to climb afterwards, maybe. And then who cares? The race is over. If you're sore for 3-4 days, who cares? But the way it impacts your training, I'm realizing, is where you might want to keep your foot to the flame more often with the downhill work. So I'm going to say every week, but every other week, a big sole focus on it. That's what I'm landing on. What about you?
Yeah. Well, the science, the research says that eccentric damage, if you really go after it, once you've established the ability to withstand eccentric damage, which is all downhill work, eccentric damage on your legs, 14 to 20 days is roughly how long you can go in between bouts in order to maintain the vast majority of the benefits you've built up. But that is only in the withstanding the damage of the work. That has nothing to do with skill. So you're right. Every 2 to 3 weeks, a big downhill effort will keep you to the point where, yeah, I'm going to be sore for a few days, but I could get back to this in like a week or two of just getting back to it just as good as I ever was. So you can maintenance every 2 to 3 weeks if you do it purposefully. But in terms of the skill and the ability to relax down a hill, which is paramount in a race, like you can rip a downhill or mm-hmm. you can flow a downhill at the exact same pace. And that skill portion has to be touched upon more often. And each person is going to be different. Your body of work leading up to it. If the 6 weeks are all that you've ever done, you're going to have to touch it every single week. But if you've done years in the mountains, you could probably get away with every other week. But skill matters. Just relaxation matters just as much as being able to handle it.
The difference between flowing a downhill and like working and fighting into the downhill is astronomical as far as what it does to your ability to do whatever comes mm-hmm. next. Rarely do we just run down a hill and then that's it, right? Getting enough repetition in and working that skill work so much that you can run fast but flowy, meaning you can open up the hips, open up the stride without having to work to do it, like allowing your mechanics to allow gravity to do most of the work for you instead of having to fight for it, just becomes so efficient. And the best can run downhill so fast with such little effort. And it is true once you just get the correct biomechanics. Mm-hmm. So, and that only comes with repetition, doing it over and over, getting comfortable with that feeling, getting comfortable with that body positioning, getting comfortable with your foot plant, getting comfortable opening up your stride and hips while you're going downhill, which is a very uncomfortable feeling for a lot of people, to raise your leg up, even though the ground beneath you is going down. Very weird feeling. People don't think about that. It's mm-hmm. what Johnny Luna Lima is so good at. You got to get so good that you feel like you can flow your downhills. This is what, run fast, but yet you're not getting a huge heart rate response. So
yes. So two short-term personal recent experiences in this. I ran this Lapham workout, this hill workout I did today. I did this with Tim Lambiris 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I was running 158 to 162 heart rate on the way up and then turn and try to flow the down. And my heart rate was climbing to the 160s on the descent.
Hmm.
I was running and feeling muscularly good, but my heart rate was rising because I was tense and not used to it. This, just one session later, my heart rate was dropping to the 140s on the way down, running faster reps than I was last time. So just returning to that little bit of efficiency, it was the difference between my heart rate spiking on the downhill and recovering on the downhill. And then the second piece, and this just happened on Sunday, my very last rep, I did the same workout I did with Ross Wiemer 2 years ago. And on the last rep, this is the first hill workout of the getting back after surgery block that I did last time. I just repeated the workout to see how I would feel. And after an hour, I ripped the last ski hill descent. And mine is a quarter mile ski hill. Maybe slightly, maybe, no, it's less. It's definitely less than that. It's probably like 280 meters. So it's not very big. Last time I ran it in, I want to say 40 seconds. And it was 429 pace, and it felt like 329 pace. And I got like a crink in my neck, and my back ached the rest of the day, and it was so uncomfortable. And this time I thought, I'm just going to do like 90% of that, and I went 39 seconds. So I was 1 second faster. This was 421 pace versus 429 pace down that hill, and it felt like I could just jog back up and do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Just 2 years of doing hill work made it, I was relaxed doing it rather than feeling like I was just about to crack apart at the seams. It's just the difference right there between relaxed versus fighting the hill.
I just looked at a downhill Strava segment. I had run it on Friday. And the old crowns, the top three are from me, you, and Mike Ferguson when we did a hill workout at Highland where we were ripping descents as well. Okay. Yeah, and guess who had the crown, Bracken? You want to know what you ran? I have the crown on it.
Which section was this? Was this the dirt section,
the gravel,
or the nasty?
The gravel descent. There's a gravel maintenance descent that we would take on a loop.
That one was you, and you were like 355 or 359 pace, I thought.
Oh, it's like 323 or 303 or 320. It's something ridiculous. Oh, and you guys are only a couple seconds behind.
You're so fast on that.
That like 15% grade downhill is my sweet spot. But then we had a steep technical descent in which it was shorter, but very steep. And you have that by a second, I think. And I tried. I couldn't get it. It's different now. They changed that trail, but I don't know what the point of that was, but it did remind me of downhill running, how fast you can run downhill. When it clicking, it's clicking. And people, you don't think you can, like, oh, you got to run uphill fast and that's going to be the key to you breaking through in your race. Wrong. It takes both. And sometimes it takes downhill running more than the uphill running.
And if you put the costly work in beforehand for uphills, they're still costly on race day. You're just faster. If you put the costly work in on downhills before a race day, it is free speed on race day.
Free speed,
baby. Because you can handle it and recover.
Yep.
It's a great equalizer is the downhill. It takes genetic talent to run uphill. It does not to run downhill. And so you can pour as much time into uphills as you want. You will never be Kilian Jornet unless you are genetically as talented as he is. Yep. Doesn't matter if you outwork him, and you might not outwork him. But you could run downhills with him if you practiced it enough.
I think that's true, at least for a portion of the time.
And so every mediocre run-of-the-mill runner out there should do everything they can if they run hilly races to become spectacular downhill runners because it's free.
And it'll improve your placement beyond measure.
Yeah.
Now should we ask the next one?
Yeah, I'm done now.
Jason West, another question for the podcast. Suppose I found an extra hour each day to cross train with low impact cardio to supplement an already good running plan. What should this hour of cross training look like? Should it include intervals or hard tempo efforts each week, or just stay aerobic every day? How would these harder efforts be placed in relation to my quality runs? Thanks for all you do.
Why don't you start that one off?
Well, I don't know if I would. If I had a good running plan and I was hitting quality work, threshold work, long runs, everything else, to be honest, man, I would add this extra hour in, like in the afternoon or evening after my quality days and some other sessions, I'd probably add it in as extra aerobic volume. And if I were to do anything quality with it, what I would do is really short, spicy, spiky workout, maybe short hit style unlike what we call our midweek long run Thursday, which is also a skill day, where maybe I would do a midweek long run of 10 miles and then in the afternoon I'd go hit 30-30 intervals on the assault bike and just slam. But I don't even know if you'd be getting a lot of juice out of that squeeze if you're on, as you said, a good run program. I would add additional aerobic volume like after your Tuesday quality day, maybe as a double day on a Thursday, and then maybe one other day. I don't even know if I would say you need or should do it every day. I think you're going to get such a diminishing return on investment after like three times a week that maybe you could save that time for rehab or stretching or something else. I know that's not the principle of your question, but I'm just trying to stay foundational with my thoughts on this. So
you just have an extra hour per day. What would you do with it?
Yeah. And what should this look like? Yeah. Intervals, hard tempos, stay aerobic. Yeah. Where would they be placed?
Yeah, that's if you have everything in line, there's really only two options. Add extra easy work.
Yeah.
And that does change the game for some people. But if you're already at your high end of what you can handle, I don't know if Jason is or not, but maybe it's diminishing returns, or you look at it like this is an entire bonus. What is the thing I've always thought, you know, if I could just add this piece, it'd probably round out my training. That's what you do. And it doesn't matter what it is. If it's extra skill work, if it's extra aerobic work, if it's just power hiking uphill, if it's downhill specific work, if it's time on the assault bike, whatever piece, if you looked and said, if a pro athlete, if it's Hunter or Jakob Ingebrigtsen or Eliud Kipchoge, if a pro athlete dissected my training plan, what would they say is missing? That's just what you use your time for. Round it out. And if it is rounded, add that, like the frilly stuff, the stuff that you've wanted to do but never found time for. But otherwise, yeah, just power hike and run another hour every day. But that's a lot of extra work.
It's a really good question, by the way. I'm not trying to like deflate the quality of that question because it's a good question. It really is. but we're hanging on the principle of a sound running program being the foundation of what you're doing. If that's not the case, then this is a whole different conversation that we could go on for 2 hours about.
It's easier if your training plan sucks.
Yeah, exactly. Oftentimes I will say when I'm in transition between pure run work to OCR work, like, hey, I got a race coming up. I do sometimes transition with, like, on my Thursday, which would be a midweek long run or a skill day, I may add like a compromised assault bike workout before I dilute the running I'm doing, because it's still important for me to stay to, like, let's say my pure running. I'm trying to improve my run metrics. Well, then maybe I'll do some assault bike to pull ups, assault bike to like compromise work just to start to get used to transitioning. So for example, even if my run volume is perfect, my run plan is great. It's doing exactly what I want to, but I'm not quite willing to give up my pure run workouts yet. There is a place for that beginning compromised work on a different modality. And then I'd say you can start working hard in that because it's a little different and it's a transitional phase for me, which I've done. But again, that's a very specific circumstance at a very specific time. I'm not repeating that for perpetuity. It might be a 2 to 4 week block where I start my compromised work there because I want my cake and eat it too. I want to get all my pure run work done and I want to start getting ready for transitions. That might be the exception to the rule. And I found a lot of success with that, but it wouldn't be something I would sustain. I don't know if that muddied the waters more or cleared them up, but...
It was applicable to you, Kirk. That's what matters.
Maybe one other listener out there.
I know Jason a little bit. I at least know him as an athlete some amount, and I've watched his races and his results. So I know his skill set a bit. He is as close to obstacle bulletproof as the average person's going to get. He has all the functional strength he could ever need. And so if he has an extra hour per day, I think it goes right back to what you said. Add in extra aerobic work 3 times per week.
Yep.
And maybe some additional mechanical speed work to just improve your running. Because Jason, speaking directly to you, I don't think you've lost a race ever based on your athleticism or obstacles. If you don't win, it's because the runner is faster than you. And that's the same boat that most of us are in. And so then you dedicate more time to building your engine.
That's a good answer.
What would you do with an extra hour, personally? If you had an extra hour in your day, every day? Because I know what I would do. Mine's easy, but what is yours?
I would go 3 times a week, pure mobility and ancillary band work. If I was like, you have an hour and you have to use it. I'm choosing to work and do other things with my free time now. But I would do mobility and I would do band, like the lateral work, the piddly stuff, as we talked about with our PTs a few episodes back. So I would do that stuff and then I would nap. That would move the needle for me more than anything. And I know that's a cop-out answer, but it's the truth. I haven't taken a nap, Bracken, in 6 months. God, this guy's dying for a nap. I think it would serve me well.
Maybe we should have just not recorded today. You could have taken a little snooze.
Nah, we gotta be showing up for the running public.
I would double run 2x per week. I would spend 2 days per week doing more cardio station work, like ski erg, assault bike, getting ready for hybrid racing next year, and I would add in a Metcon. And then the other 2 days, that'd be 3, 4, 5. The other 2 days, I would nap.
Yeah, nap is a good use of time if you're a highly trained athlete.
Hobie Call napped every single day.
On his lunch hour at work. Amazing.
So sometimes the very best thing you can do with an hour is just sleep, and then you can crush your next workout.
Dude, so true. Okay, I want to get to 2 more, and we got to do it in 10 minutes. Hunter Maynard says, hey guys, message for Kirk. Never mind, Bracken, you can tune out.
Okay, I will.
I'm wondering if I'd benefit from Kirk's high volume but low run volume program. I'm training for a road half and running 60 to 70 miles a week. Doing 2 lactate threshold type sessions on Tuesday and Thursday, shorter intervals on Tuesday and longer on Thursday, and a long run on Saturday with some tempo or pickups in there. Running 6 days a week with 1 to 2 strength sessions and then another 5 to 8 hours of easy aerobic work like the bike or Stairmaster around that. I'm wondering if I basically did cross training and Metcons and only ran my workouts, what the results would be. And is your cross training like an incline hike for an hour or more like a Dylan Scott stuff? Any framework you use to create these Metcons? Thanks, guys. I'm going to re-listen to your podcast with Rylan S2 because I think you guys addressed that directly. Christ, you're running 60 to 70 miles a week and doing 5 to 8 hours of easy aerobic work like the bike or Stairmaster. Running.
It's tougher when people are doing a lot of good stuff already.
Well, yeah, because see, mine is because I can't run as much as I want. I'm doing 60 miles a week in volume, but only 30 or 40 of that is running. So I'm doing the same volume as you are running in total as far as time spent aerobically, but less of it is running than you. So what I'm getting at is, and you know, Ryan Atkins made a post about this, and take it for what you take it, but it said, turns out not running isn't good for your running, with that, like, I don't know emoji. Well, no shit. Not running is not good for your running. So to run less and change your recovery days in between, I actually think is a mistake. If you are able to run, continue to do so. I don't think my model is for you, because I think you can run enough. And you're already getting in, we just addressed it, extra 5 to 8 hours of easy aerobic cross training on top of your 60, 70 miles a week. You're doing exactly what we just said to do with your extra time in a highly trained, well-programmed run program. So you're actually nailing it, unless you're feeling fatigued, unless you have injuries coming on, unless there's something I'm missing here. I don't think I would change much. What about you?
This is purely speculating. If you're doing that much aerobic work, the tendency is sometimes to miss on the strength or the intensity end. So you can hit both of those at once with maybe a Metcon or two that's like just 5 to 10 minutes long and just hit it spicy. That could be the kind of thing that could change things a little bit. A little bit of mechanical speed work, some stride work, a little bit of short Metcon work, and you're done. But you would have to see the full training plan. But I would say if you can run 60 to 70 miles a week and 5 to 8 hours of cross training, you're living the life.
I mean, you're doing very well.
Keep living it and love the fact that you're healthy doing so.
Plus 1 to 2 days of strength sessions. I would say, like, the way I'm sneaking it in now, for example, my strength. So I've been busier and busier over the years, and my time is at a premium. So I've learned to become more efficient with my time. And now when you look on my Strava and you see like 60-minute indoor bike and it says nothing else, it's like average heart rate, 130. Well, I'm not just on my bike for an hour. I'm on my bike for 3 minutes, quick strength circuit, back on the bike for 2 minutes, strength circuit. And so I'm getting a twofer. I'm keeping my heart rate in a recovery aerobic zone, and I'm getting my strength work in. But that's for a guy on a pinch. That's me running a tight schedule, trying to be efficient with both. I'm killing two birds with one stone, right? But that doesn't seem to apply to you either. So your suggestion of Metcon work, I like that suggestion. I'm doing that suggestion, but at an aerobic rate. And again, that's just because of time crunch. That's not because it's by grand design. By grand design, I'd probably still separate it. So I probably didn't help you at all here, sir, and I'm very sorry.
I'll give you another chance. We've got another question for you, but I have something to say on it because it applies to a few athletes I work with and my situation in the past. Question mostly for the Hunter Kirk. There's a lot of stuff here. What tactics should trail mountain runners use when in new and different locations with different wildlife that could potentially kill or injure the runner or the pup? Would you recommend, when completely off the grid, away from civilization, carrying a small firearm, knife, or just bear spray? Or just full send, barehanded battle, whatever comes across your way in the woods while running? Love you guys.
Who asked this question? I need to know these things, Bracken.
Mark Falcone.
I think we could both answer this question.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's simple, actually, because I lived at the base of the Rockies and spent time running anywhere from 7 to 14,000 feet in the Rockies, where you encounter lots of things that can kill you. Mm-hmm. I bought a small Bluetooth speaker, and I just blasted music when I ran solo. It was that simple.
It's a very smart idea.
And it's better than bells. Should you have bear spray? Yeah. It's not infallible. Did Killian and certain people, did they run with a small firearm? Yeah. If it's a mountain lion, you're not going to see it. It's going to be on you, and you're not going to be able to get the gun out in time. It's probably more helpful with a bear, and simply for the noise it's going to create. Mm-hmm. And so if noise is your biggest weapon anyway, just blast music in the speakers when you're alone. There's no one else out there on the trail anyway. You're not going to offend anyone. Just blast it.
Most attacks are because you're surprising something. So it knowing you're coming is key. But there are instances where that doesn't matter. In fact, the tough part about that is then you lose your sense of hearing as well, just like wearing headphones, so you can't hear the crack in the brush or the, you know, the snap of a twig. And so then your senses also become dulled. When I'm in a place in which I'm uncomfortable, which I'll do Canada runs sometimes, and there's a lot of bears up there, and obviously I'm not the bear's biggest fan still from my little attack a few years ago. And then mountains, is I will always carry my, like, Salomon vest on me. It probably won't have any water in it, but it will have, now I'm just cautious, but I will always have a pocket knife in there. I will have my cell phone, because you're going to need to be able to, if there's service, you need to get in touch with somebody, which is typically you get attacked and then you can't find help or get out in time. And you either bleed out or you get lost or something happens. And so you need to have a way to contact people. So that's a must. For me, the tricky part is this. Firearms are, other than the noise factor, in that moment, you're, no matter how trained you are, you are probably going to miss. You're probably going to mess this up. A bear spray casts a very wide radius, and that part, those particles float in the air, and it is way, you just point in the general direction and you're going to hit what you're aiming at, and it renders them just as useless as a gunshot. In fact, more useless most of the time. A bullet entering a bear is going to piss it off. It's going to continue its attack unless you hit it between the temple. The only issue with bear spray is the good bear sprays are big and clunky. They're very large, or the size of a Yeti, some of them, and it's tough to figure out where to put that. So that's where the difficult thing lies. So a bear spray canister will sit in your water bottle holder on like the front pouch of your vest. That's the best place for it. Attached to your waist, it doesn't sit well. You just have to make sure the safety is on there. So if I'm very concerned, I will put a bear spray, which is a full size, it's like a 16-ounce deal. It's like the size of a water bottle, in that front pocket. I will have a pocket knife on me, and I usually will carry some sort of like, not first aid, but like if I need a wrap, something to wrap, or like jerry rig a tourniquet, I think that's important as well, which can just be athletic tape. You can find a stick and create your own tourniquet if anybody knows anything about that. But if I'm real nervous, those are the things that I'm going to bring with me.
Yeah.
And then I'll also have a very small pepper spray, which I will attach to my waist, which is the easiest to access. It's like a tiny little, it's like the size of a lipstick thing, a little bigger. But the bear spray is the tricky one, because that's what you really need. That's your number one defense against any animal or any encounter or any person. But it's large, so you put that in the front pocket of your vest and place your soft bladder. Just make sure it doesn't go off in your own face, because that's going to be a long day for you. That's a long answer.
If you carry anything, it has to be accessible in under a second.
That's the thing, is people put them in their bag where they, you need to get it that fast. Otherwise, don't bring it.
Even like a pistol on the small of your back, there's chances that you just don't get your hand to the small of your back in time.
100%.
Like if you're on your back, most likely your hands are going to be right by your sternum or your chest somewhere, or up by your face. You have to be able to get whatever you have from right there. If an animal has you down, then you can just fire blindly up into its face or its gut or whatever you're going to do. But most likely, you'll never get it out unless it's something you can have out in less than a second. And if you run at dusk, here's the key. Have your music, have your front-facing light, and have a back-facing light. There are predators who are you're going to surprise, and predators who are going to surprise you. And if a predator is going to surprise you, usually it will not be coming at your face. And so you need to have a light pointing backwards, which is going to spook the cat.
Yeah.
Because most likely it's going to be a cat.
It's true. It's a very good point. Yeah, but you're right. Accessibility. All this talk is for nothing other than like a tourniquet or some bandages or your cell phone. Those are all fine to have tucked, because you're not grabbing your cell phone as the bear's coming at you. And then that pocket knife is always right in the front. And you like, you hear stories. I hear them all the time. I listen to these outdoor podcasts. And that pocket knife is in like a front pouch of your vest. And if that bear is on top of you, you can literally somehow find a way to get your hand in there, flick it open, and just jab the thing from underneath. And that saves some people's lives, just having that accessible, flippable pocket knife. Doesn't need to be big, but at least you know you have options. But the biggest one, honestly, bear spray, and be able to pull it out and practice it. That second matters, because that's about the amount of time I had when I realized I was in trouble once, and I might have been able to pull it off. Maybe. But still, I'm not sure. And I wasn't running. I was just walking. So nonetheless, that's a good question.
It is. Very good question.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bracken.
You happy to end on that?
Yeah, I think so.
Let's do it.
We got one about recovering from World's Toughest Mudder next, but I think we have time to hit that because that's not till November.
Okay.
Are you cool with that?
Ice cold, Kirk.
Yeah.
Ice cold.
Anything you want to end with? Oh, we got t-shirts coming.
Woo.
T-shirts have been ordered. They are super sweet. We've got 3 new colors coming. And the traditional running public yellow. And we also have stocking caps that just came to my door yesterday. So we are going to be primed and ready to fill your closets, folks. And they are sweet. So you'll hear more about that coming up.
Just like that. We run out of t-shirts. Bam. We reload them.
A year later. Quick turnaround.
We are not messing around here.
We are not. All right.
Enjoy your weekends.
Enjoy your weekends.